This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is The Rundown. So remember back in 2020 when we were talking a lot about essential workers? People were out banging on their pots and pans to celebrate doctors and healthcare workers as they came home from the ICU. And I'm glad these folks got some recognition, but healthcare providers have always been on the front lines. And let them tell it, they've never had enough resources. I also think about the similarly under-resourced mental health workers, especially the ones who support people dealing with the most severe psychoses.
First, I was a social worker. I was pretty fresh out of school. I literally 5-6 months out of school. You know, and I took on this job as the supervisor of an ACT team, assertive community treatment.
This is Zach Mucha. He's a social worker, psychoanalyst, poet, and the president of the Chicago Center for Psychoanalysis. And he recently came out with a book called Swimming to the Horizon, Crack, Psychosis, and Street Corner Social Work. And like he said, he got his start running an assertive community treatment team. Basically, he and his team worked in a community mental health agency, and they served clients who really had no other support. Their client situations were so severe that they couldn't or wouldn't come in for appointments. So Zach and his team went to them. They went around Uptown, Edgewater, Rogers Park to support people who had been through every other system you can think of.
Clients were suffering severe psychosis, substance issues, homelessness, incarceration, all the socioeconomic bad effects of really traumatized and traumatizing lives.
This experience was extremely eye-opening for Zach, especially because of how out of touch he says the system felt when he was there. Like ACT programs requiring patients to take their medication in order to access their disability checks.
To say, you know, you're not going to get your money until you get your meds is a gross power dynamic. It was what people thought worked. I mean, you know, compliance was always the phrase, but you know, the people we were working with were non-compliant from the beginning. That's why they were working with us.
What I love about talking to Zach is hearing all the ways he challenged the flaws in this system. He saw what wasn't working for his clients and figured out how to do things differently. So did his other team members. And that's not a skill that comes easily for most people, especially when you're doing work that can feel so thankless. So I wanted to understand where this kind of ideology came from. We started by talking about what it was like starting out as a social worker.
I took the jobs no one else wanted. I worked at Cook County Jail Psych for my internships and went to this community agency afterward. And I just figured, all right, I'm not going to say no to anything. Mm-hmm. And I really liked the idea of running this team. And I was very proud that over time, we built it into something pretty cool.
Yeah. I want to get into some of the interactions that you described so vividly. I'm like, is this from memory? Were you taking notes? Profuse notes? You know, at this time, yeah, it must have been the notes, right?
I was taking notes, yeah.
Yeah. Really beautiful storytelling. It just reminds me of conversations that I've had with people in my life who are dealing with schizophrenia, with bipolar disorder, right? You have this phrase that you said became a mantra for a while, which was, you're talking to somebody, they are dealing with a psychosis, they're dealing with addiction, and they say something to you, and you're like, what the hell do I say to that?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've had this moment, you know, once or twice a month when I talk to my cousin, mm-hmm. for instance, you know, who has schizophrenia. By the end, though, of your 7-8 years working with folks with these severe psychoses, was this still a mantra for you? Did you still find yourself at a loss for words?
Less and less so. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really figure out how to, it's a very different form of listening. It's a very different form of, you're not trying to convince someone of something. I mean, one thing I would always talk to the team about is that everyone we work with, anyone on the planet also, needs to be heard and needs to feel safe. That's the one thing to put across. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, we are on their side. We have to earn the trust of the people we're working with, whether it's as a sit-down psychoanalyst now or if I'm running around Wilson Avenue. I mean, the worst thing I could say to you is, Aaron, just trust me. I mean, what's the first response?
You're
smiling uncomfortably. Yeah. Right. I mean, yeah. I have to earn your trust. Mm-hmm. That's it. And that was our job. We had to earn the trust of people who, you know, had been failed over and over again.
Yeah.
I wonder if you can read this passage from the book for me. This is a paragraph on page 23 of Swimming to the Horizon.
But here was this guy who stood a head taller than me, had 20 years on me, had done 2 tours of duty in Vietnam, and was now stuck depending on me to keep him from being homeless. I had no right to say trust me and expect anyone to do so, especially in a relationship where power imbalances hung over every conversation. During my internship at Cook County Jail, if I expressed any belief about the fragility of a client, their dependence on my skills, or my inability to help them, my supervisor would set me straight. These people are much tougher than you think, he said. They have survived everything without starving to death before they met you. If you were to die tomorrow, they would be just fine.
After having finished this book, having gone around talking about it, going back to that place way back when you were at your internship and hearing what that person, rereading and returning to what that person said to you, how does that feel for you? How does that land for you? They would be just fine.
It's true. I mean, they would survive without me. But also, I think we have to make the effort to improve someone's life, to help them. Mm. I mean, one thing I really hold on to, and I did not know this back then, Levinas, the philosopher, who lost his entire family in the Holocaust, afterward, his work was really based on our irreducible responsibility to the other person. First one, do not kill them. Second one, do not look away from someone else who's suffering. And just that basic responsibility to not look away. Because mm-hmm. everyone we were working with were the people we look away from the street because they are scary, it is uncomfortable, this is someone who's really suffering, and there are no easy answers. So, and you know, it's a natural urge to want to look away because it's painful. Mm-hmm. But the idea of compassion literally means to feel with and to feel that person's pain. That's what we can do.
Yeah. When we see these people, right, these people that you're confronting, you know, you were confronting on a daily basis, and, you know, most of us, we look away because, like you said, it's painful. I mean, compounded on top of that is that these folks are criminalized.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, okay, it's because of lack of food or water or money, they stole something, or because of their paranoia or they're working out their trauma, they are defensive and they might attack someone, right? I've heard anecdotes of people, okay, well, I spent a couple of nights in a jail cell, somebody did some first aid on my foot, you know, and I had a place to sleep that was warm for the night. And so that is a baseline of stabilization for a little bit, but generally jail ain't solving their problems, you know? And I wonder why you think after so long we haven't figured this out as an absolute fact that, like, jail is not the answer.
We haven't figured it out because, you know, as a culture, we don't want to. Hmm. We don't want to come to the answer that, all right, this is going to cost money. People need housing first. I mean, it's a basic thing, but it worked. It worked when we had our emergency housing to get people safe, then they start making better choices. And I can't make any healthy, helpful choices if I'm worried about getting killed in my sleep. And if I go to a homeless shelter, I'm not going to take my meds because they're going to knock me out and I'm going to wake up with all my stuff gone. Mm-hmm. And just basic problems that just are not considered. And sending people to homeless shelters, it's useless. And jail itself, I mean, needs to be, you know, totally, totally corrected. Why do we not have private cells, private baths? Yeah, it's going to cost money. And no one's going to get reelected on that, on that platform.
Yeah. So you're saying the average person and the person making the decisions don't feel that there is a tangible benefit from investing in reforming prison, for instance.
I believe so. Yeah. And there's also, you know, the moralizing that goes along with, you know, generally see someone on the street, well, they must have done something. They have some, which of course, you know, makes me, the viewer, I feel better about myself because I'm not them, mm-hmm. which it's a terrible way to decide who deserves help or not. Are they like me or not? Mm. And that's how a lot of these decisions are made. Mm-hmm.
Hmm. It's making me think of this compassion reframing of like, yes, they are like me.
Mm-hmm.
And then how can we go from there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we have to see that they are like me. I am like them. Without that, we're giving orders to people. Mm-hmm. And who likes being told what to do?
You are also a poet.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard you talk about in interviews how the experience of consuming poetry aligns so much with the experience of practicing psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say more about this? Where is this most evident when it comes up when you're working with people with psychosis?
Working with people with psychosis or even people who are not suffering psychosis. Mm-hmm. Poetry for me is very much like, you know, an analytic session. You're listening for what's not there, what's between the lines, and what's not being said, what's being said, mm-hmm. and just what, you know, how things get put next to each other. What comes after this? What comes after that? And why? And it's a thing I've noticed that there's a real parallel between poetry and psychoanalysis or psychotherapy, mm-hmm. where you're listening and trying to help your patient, your partner, you know, find a different way for them to tell their story to themselves.
Mm.
And I think that's one of the things that happens is that, you know, it's all about we continue, you know, becoming whatever it is we're supposed to become. And that only happens if we're allowed to play with our story a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And poetry is a great way to do that because it just, you know, it's the part that's not said in normal conversation.
Mm. Hmm. I love that. That's such a beautiful reflection. Close to the end of the book, you introduce us to one of your patients, Amos. You talk about eventually centering relationships over everything in your work with patients. You kind of just went with it with Amos.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that you feel came natural for you?
I'm hesitant to say yes, but I think so. I mean, I think it was natural to just, all right, I think I know what might help this person, but I better hang back. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, one of the things I really learned in doing all this work is how helpful it is to admit to myself, I don't know, and to wait and see whether it's running around or sitting in my office with a patient now,
mm-hmm.
to say, I don't know, let's keep talking and figure this out.
Yeah. The book title, Swimming to the Horizon, is kind of this metaphor, and I wonder if you can talk about that title and what it means to you.
Sure. The title came from conversation I had with a really talented, dedicated staffer, and she was so dedicated, I would have to literally threaten that I was going to unplug her computer while she was typing, because she had to go home.
She was working too late, working too hard.
Working too hard, working too late. There was always something, there was always something more to do, and there always was. And I was really trying to get it across to her that we are not going to, we ourselves, our team, we are not going to cure homelessness. We are not going to cure schizophrenia. We can only do what we can. I said, we are swimming to the horizon. Mm-hmm. Worst thing we could do is totally ignore our own lives. And, you know, we end up in terrible personal situations. Mm-hmm. And then we have to take time off from work to fix our lives. But, no, the idea that we do what we can, you know, for the time we have.
Zach Mucha is a social worker, psychoanalyst, poet, and the president of the Chicago Center for Psychoanalysis. Zach, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was fun.
Zach's new book is called Swimming to the Horizon, Crack, Psychosis, and Street Corner Social Work. It's out now. And that's it for today. Justin Bull, Sarah Stark, and I produce The Rundown. Ariel Van Cleve is the editor and executive producer of the show. Our theme music is by Louis Weeks. The Rundown is produced by WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you for listening to the show. I'll talk to you tomorrow.